Thank you. What else? I think that's fine. Got everything. I'm going to now as well. Alright. Okay, we'll put our heads together. Do we wait for a new document? Alright. Then we'll approve it tomorrow.
I don't like the sound of that at all, if I may say so. And it remains my view that this bill should be done properly and therefore in the next parliament. I'm not available on the Wednesday.
Otherwise, we're not going to finish it, and I think that then all the time we've spent on the bill, the public hearings, etc. I think the recess is part of the days on which we can see when can we meet and try to move forward at the end of this day. Thank you.
Mr. Scott?
Sure, I don't mind meeting on Tuesday, but I would like to plead that we consider the fact that Ms. Matthew is not here next Wednesday. Her inputs are very valued from her experience. I do also wish to state that this is a far-reaching bill. In the past, we've had the sexual offenders bill, we had the child justice law that went over certain parts. We need to understand there are far-reaching implications here. And whilst this is an old bill, it's only been before us as a committee from the beginning of this year or maybe towards the end of last year. So in my experience of those other bills, which one doesn't want that necessarily to happen, but the sexual offences bill and child justice was with us as a committee for 5-6 years, whilst we deliberated on the far-reaching implications of the bills. I would submit that this is similar, has massive implications, and we need to bear that in mind. So I would suggest, I'm prepared to meet next Tuesday. Can we not accommodate Ms. Munch and say, look, we don't meet on Wednesday then? At least we can see how far we can get on Tuesday. Bear in mind that it's not officially parliamentary sitting or for committees.
Mr. Jeffrey.
I mean, just to correct Mr. Stefanioni, I think the bill is older than 12 because it was started by Dalla Omar. So he was Minister of Justice in the first 5 years. So I think it's probably more.
The problem is that it was never properly conceived. It's the process
that is not properly the issue is, and it's a 2012 bill, so I don't know, Mr. Bassett can probably say when it was introduced, but we've had it nearly a year. Sorry? May last year. So we've had it over a year. And I don't think that the pointing out the length of time that the Child Justice Bill or the Sexual Offences Bill took are necessarily examples of best practice. And sexual offences particularly has been the subject of successful challenges. So, you know, I don't know if you're then saying, well, maybe we should have taken longer. But I really want to appeal that we do use both days. I mean, I had in fact said, you know, Chair, when you were looking at other days, that I'm not available on one particular day. I am now available on those 2 days, but as indicated, I thought things should proceed, not to hold everything up. Because we're not going to be making decisions. We're going to be processing. And we're going to be crystallizing the issues that need to be looked at. So I don't think that Ms. Smuts would be excluded. I mean, it would have been a pity if she were there, but I don't think the fact that any single member of the committee is not available then should mean that the committee can't meet.
Ms. Adams.
And otherwise, it's basically, if we're not going to finish it this year, then we may as well, or those who, well, let's make a decision on it, because otherwise we may as well stop all the work we're doing. Because the new committee will have to do everything again.
Just before you arrived, I had put to the committee the idea that we meet next week on Tuesday and Wednesday to process the legal practice bill, and that is the matter we are currently discussing. If you have a view, you may present it. Mr. Swart, did you want to?
I just want to emphasize again that it's not unheard of to go across Parliament sessions. And it's not the issue now to stop work. I think that's short-sighted. But it can happen that go across Parliament. It's not unheard of. And I think the point that was made about the sexual offences being challenged, I think that's irrelevant. The point is that there was a lot of consideration of taxes that were made. And it went across Parliament, and it was picked up and continued. If we can finish this, sure. But let's not put undue pressure on ourselves, considering the vast implications of this book. This is not normal. We're dealing here with judiciary, with the implication of the independence of the judiciary. So I would just emphasize that let's be very careful how we deal with this, considering the implications of where we are going to with the book. Thank you.
Chairperson, for the whole constituency period, I do have other plans that has already been confirmed, so I would not be available either on Tuesday or on Wednesday. But it, given the fact that it has already been tabled in May 2012, it seems like the problem is with the portfolio committee that we haven't done our work immediately as what we should have. Of course, we've had a lot of other matters that we had to attend and one takes that in into consideration. My proposal would be that we first decide whether we, in fact, whether we have the time, whether we can finalize this bill, and whether we can't do it. Because it seems like there's quite a lot of work that needs to take place, and time is running against us. But in any event, I won't be available.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know if we have actually ruled out the possibility of working in the evenings, because we could do it this week.
Mr. Jeffrey.
I think just also responding on Mr. Swart's point, if we don't finish the bill, then the new parliament would really have to, even though there may be a repeat, some members may remain, the new parliament would have to consider everything from scratch, have hearings, etc., and given the different interests reflected in the bill, I'm sure those people opposing the bill would be very happy. I think it's imperative that we do pass the bill. I think it's our duty, and we've got to find the time to do it, and I think that's obvious. The problem about meeting in the week is that we're sitting till late tonight. We're sitting till late on Thursday night. It may be that with other bills, child justice bill being one of them, we had a sort of smaller group, and PPI was another one. We had a smaller group looking at the bill and then reporting back. I would want to say that it's not, we want as many people as possible, but it's not a requirement that everybody must attend, although it's credible.
Mr. Sibanini?
Yeah, Chairperson, because just to follow up on what Honorable Chief is saying, because it's not as one or two members not being available for next week. But if I listen properly, it also seems some of our members are also not prepared to sit in the evenings, neither this week nor any time. And then it sounds as if we'll be having a problem of moving very slow with the end result that we want to finalize this bill. Because like we did in the sexual offences, or the child justice bill, if we are determined to say we want to put an end, I think one would expect that members should be prepared to say, if we can't meet during recess, then we are prepared to meet in the evening. And then my view is, Chairperson, I think we should not be bending backwards to try and accommodate. It has happened that in some of the bills, there will be persons or honorable members who won't be available to attend in some of the discussions, but only when we're going to make decisions or address them, that we make sure that we accommodate as broad or as many people as possible, many members as possible, Chairperson. I feel we should be prepared, all of us, to say we want to make some progress, we want to advance so far as this legal practice bill is concerned. It has been discussed widely. Thank you.
Mr. Robistore.
Chairperson, you know, as you were talking about the fact that a lot of work has already been done, early child conscience came to mind, that are we not going to have the work that has already been done being fruitless and wasteful expenditure if we don't finish? And I think Parliament should lead by example. We don't talk to departments to say we don't want fruitless expenditure and we can't walk the walk. I think we must make sure that we finish this bill.
Act also provides the Minister Magazine, the board is a minister, blah blah blah. that is something that we're going to look at, and we've also asked them to look at other jurisdictions, and we will review that.
Yes, thanks for reminding us, Mr. Bassett. I had recalled something, but my memory failed me. All right. Minister approaching court.
Thank you. For two of chapter two, deals with operation of councils, such as meetings, quorum, procedure, decisions, etc. The LRC suggested that there should be regulations, but the department feels it is too important, it should be dealt with in primary legislation.
If I may come in as well, virtually all other statutory bodies, that these issues are dealt with in legislation, not in regulation. There might be one or two exceptions, but the operation of statutory bodies is spelled out in full in primary legislation.
It's rather unusual for a body like the LRC to want to put something like this in regulations, hey?
Right.
I don't think we have a problem there.
The next comment is from the GPD on page 17, decisions of council. The GPD wants a veto right for advocates in respect of matters peculiar to advocates. The department then feels required to the structure, possibly two separate chambers. The intention is not that there should be done, but that there should be a single regulatory regime.
Right, you know, I think that there ought to be parity if the thing takes this form at all. But let me ask you this. If the intention, for example, when you say that the council sets norms and standards, do you mean that they're going to be determining practice rules, conduct rules? Therefore, if the council composed by the majority of attorneys going to start writing the bar rules or amending them? Is that the intention?
Of
some of the problems, but I guess the judges who ought to another thing. And the bill talks only about norms and standards and then education, this, that, and the other. But we need to think through each category of things which they could conceivably be empowered to rule upon.
Is the role of the rules board solely to set fees?
No, but it's one of their points.
Mr. Sikosan, sorry.
Yes. When we discussed this matter, we basically realized that some of the rules that are formulated either by attorneys or advocates basically belong to the procedures in the court, the rules of court. In some of the procedures in the court, it's mainly because they have not been a kind of a proactive approach by the sport to make sure that everything is covered. So it is that they looked at it as part of capacitating and broadening the role of the sport in terms of the management. And take into account that the sport in its revamped composition will also allow participation process, because it's unfair for rules that are to be formulated in a closed room and endorsed and finalized and get implemented. So we wanted the process to be democratized, the whole conduct of the proceedings. That's one part. And the second part, we anticipate and we want to operate that could look at specific aspects that pertain to the process. Obviously, we do not anticipate in practice that the majority of attorneys would want to rule on a matter that pertains to the profession, but the council may take that matter, that the business commission look at other case issues, that can look at attorney issues, and look into the specific the profession, so to come to the council, those aspects have been taken care of by the people affected by process committees. It would be very unfortunate if the Minister of Advocates or the Minister of Advocates can rule on issues for the different in the council when they are not part of the one who finds decisions. It would be very unfortunate if attorneys can take themselves to rule against the matter that pertains to advocates. But we thought that the way the committee can structure its council, which in terms of their bill is very generous and open, and that will address their concern in terms of each right. The each right, as we said, when we initially discussed that wanted either each right or some form of weight in terms of their votes, so that even if that vote of one advocate counts twice, that would be very clumsy and cumbersome process. So we thought that in the direction of the majority of the council, and consensus will be reached, the chairperson will be there, and we anticipate that work will come from the committees per se, and to the extent that the rules board can complement rules that pertain to abilities in the court in general, also be allowed to play a role to allow participation. Thank you.
Move on, Mrs. Snow.
Claude, I see the work committee of the council
law, and if I requested that the word other be deleted in paragraph 2, the department agrees.
Are we okay with that, honourable members?
Very minor issue.
Yes, but well,
major
I will make a comment on that, Mr. Dyer. The way other comes up.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the wording of the section, and is this not what we are saying? That there could be other persons. Except employees of council, and my reading is there other persons from outside that could be part of committees that are set up by the council. And so I think about these specialist committees that have been formed and whether the decision, no?
All right.
He's saying that we can leave other because it means other people can come in, but it doesn't, because it says A, one third members of the council only. So I think that only is that problem. So I'm not going to take out the only. The other members of the council only, or any other person. So we should then allow for the council and other persons in two. I think that's what they're saying.
That's where the problem arose with the word only.
Yeah, I didn't understand the Law Society's objection, or the department, excluding Mr. Dyer, it seems, agreement that that should come out. I mean, to my mind, it's clear. The committees may consist of members of the council only, or they may consist of any other suitable person. Or they should be members of the council, or, I mean, so you'd have one committee, because it's one or more committees. Maybe, that I don't know if this clears it up, that you want out of one to say that a committee may only consist of members of the council, but other committees may consist of members of the council or any other suitable person. Would that not be the way of dealing with it? So the amendment then should be to two members of the council, and any other suitable person, except employees of the council.
Do we have that? Okay, very good. Okay.
Clause 19 deals with the executive officer and employees of the council. The employees of ISSA requested that they be referred to here explicitly, but the department's response is that the ISSA is a voluntary association and the law cannot make provision for those personnel beyond the Labour Relations Act.
The Employees Association concern not be part of transitional provisions. I mean,
well, they were.
Are they not, and is that not covered?
Yes, transitional. Transitional provisions. What is that? Membership chairperson. 106. 96. Members of the Transitional Council. We're talking about the
staff of
the personnel of the LSSA.
I mean, is the issue not that when the Law Society is dissolved, that you want first preference at least to be given to employees of the Law Society to become employees of the council?
Because of clause 97 2 deals with this, 2 and actually more 3.
under their 97.3.
Yes, it would be. I'm completely confused. I recall some discussion that we were not going to insist that the LHSA and Bar Council be dissolved, that they were going to continue and that we couldn't interfere with their rights and association.
Well, this is going to be a negotiation conducted by the Council with those bodies. Now, we can't preempt how those negotiations will end. Mr. Susana.
We look specifically at 98.2,
right?
The transaction must give consultation to each appoint and CEO to perform access powers and functions determined by the Central Council and supervise the staff of the Council to employ or second from existing governance structures in a legal profession. So many staff members just may be necessary and able to carry its function. They conclude agreement with any person or organization for the performance of any particular act or particular work or the rendering of service for the purpose of filling the object of the Council.
Okay.
I think
bottom
line is that the position of the, Mr. Skosana, and I think it's useful referring to the sections, but we're not dealing with 97 or 98 now. We're dealing with 19. So I think that the employee's concern would come under the under Chapter 10.
Yes.
And that would then depend, following on Mrs. Schaefer's point, on what their status is going to be. But as far as the staff of the Council,
yeah,
we do not have to, we can't make provision under 19 for employees of the Law Society.
So 20 deals with executive committee of the council. Clause 22 proposes a composition of such an executive committee. The RSA feels the council should have the authority to determine the size and composition of this committee, but the department feels it should be in a bill to curb them from whatever they might do.
And should we not, I think this is an issue we might need a debate on, should the council not have the discretion, one could say at least four other members, then obviously you're giving the council that discretion. Is there a precedent in other bodies? Why four? I mean, you've got a body of 21 members. It doesn't seem unreasonable. I'm not saying I disagree with you. There are a number of issues that should, the statute, say they need another member. So we need to decide that. I'm not happy just to say we are saying it must be. In effect, we're saying six members. Should, I think we need to debate whether the discretion should be allowed. And then under three, how are they going to, do the words must have due regard to, and the same as consideration must be given to position. Under 7.1, when we, the composition of the council, as long as you've considered it, you don't have to comply with that. Because it would be, sub 3 would be very prescriptive. And I would think the answer is clearly it's not prescriptive that you have to comply with every one of those. You're not 1, 2, 3, 4, you're not going to get to 6 members. So I think we need to be careful about it being too prescriptive when we are deciding on the XCOM of this council.
All right. We'll look at the wording of what's in 7, but we come back to the question of the size of XCO. Mr. Jeffrey?
What's the current size of the Law Society of XCO? 6. Out of how many members? 21 as well. Look, I think I don't like having an entire discretion, which is what the Law Society wants. Maybe 6 is small, I don't know, we could increase it by 1 or so, but I think we should specify the maximum number. So we could say a maximum of 5 or whatever other members, but that's something, yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a big issue. On the point of 3, what is the difference between due regard to and consideration must be given? I would have thought they have a similar meaning. And if they've got a similar meaning, should we not use the same term throughout?
I don't think at all that's a consideration and broad, and you're, I mean, you're crazy. If the 6 people you want to encapsulate race, gender, disability, attorneys, advocates, and the 9 regions, or the 9 provinces, not to mention the regions, you know, one can also go crazy with this thing. That's why I said
it's due regard, but I think to my mind, due regard is sorry, basically would be if you've got, you know, when you're deciding and all these people, the chair, the deputy chair, whatever, the disabled person, come from a particular region, then, you know, the other people should come from other regions. But the point for me, Jim, is what's the difference between consideration must be given and due regard to representativity.
Okay. We look for a consistent draft there. Just a diet.
Could we revert with the following? The proper numbers regarding the current structure. My response might be incorrect. It might be slightly more. Could we come back with that? And also, could we also do just a very quick analysis of other councils, structurally governance councils, and look at how the exos are formulated in terms of numbers, and maybe just give a quick report back on that so that we have an overall feel of it.
Yes, but I do like the departments, if I may offer an opinion, the department's response, because if you leave it to the council and then they'll appoint an exco of 12, 13 members, and it's true, it's well known that smaller structures at the exco level work much better. But all right, Mr. Dyer, let's do that. Let's do that. Give us who's going to do that? Okay, good. All right. Fair enough. So Mr. Dyer will look at how other councils are structured in terms of their exos, in terms of numbers, and how they're appointed. Okay.
Claude, thank you for that. The council now from
the changes before that. Due regard and consideration. There's no response from them as from the department as to, is there a difference?
Oh, is there a difference?
Speaking off the cuff now, I tend to agree with Mr. Jeffrey. I think they say exactly the same thing, but let's just also, we would like to think about it having due regard to or considering is really, I can't see a difference. I really can't see a difference, and I think we need to just make sure that we are consistent.
Or
I think clause 7 too as well.
19.5. Yeah, whatever it appears, okay. All right, Mrs. Lowe.
Clause 27 provides the council must, from among members of the executive committee, designate the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the executive committee. The other is proposes that the chairperson of the council should be the chairperson of the executive committee, as the department agrees.
Any comments, questions, then? All right.
Clause 21 provides for the delegation of functions and assignment of functions of the council. The Lord, as I feels that this clause should provide specifically that the council might permit a person or committee from whom or which power has been delegated to sub-delegate that power in appropriate circumstances, and that the council must be empowered to delegate appropriate powers to the executive officer or employees of the council. The department agrees.
Comments, questions, honourable members? We're okay with that?
No.
Yes, Mr. Jeffrey.
The council may be engaged in writing That's a bit odd, because the council is not a person. Presumably, all that is required is the council must take a measured decision to delegate. But if you say, you know, it's the chair that will delegate in writing, but the council takes decisions, and those decisions are minuted. I think the problem is in writing. May take a decision to delegate, and as long as it's a properly constituted council meeting and it's minuted, then that's fine. I mean, their decisions would be minuted, but because it seems a bit odd that the council is a person. So I'm not sure whether you actually even need it in writing. And if you want to have that the person to whom the power is delegated has a written record that there's been a delegation, so they can't act unless, but I think you see what I'm saying around the,
This will be in the procedure of the meetings that will be determined by the council. They will provide for this.
As the council will take a decision, we're going to delegate X power to the XO, and the resolution to that effect.
Council may
resolve to delegate.
Chairperson, this wording is linked to the long debate between powers of the council and the powers of the regional councils. And we do know that from the various submissions received from the profession, there was always, and still is, a feeling, and a strong one at that, that the regional councils should be able to do whatever they currently do, and that the national council should just be the council that meets a few times, and that's all that they really do. The end product of the bill might be different in the sense that the delegated authority might be limited to certain aspects, and it might delegate to a region or regions. And it's a very fundamental point with regard to the debate of whether the profession sees itself as entrenching the current structures that it has with delegated authority and becomes a real power play, in the sense that the council should really be that authority that delegates any authority that he wants to give to a particular body, a particular region, and should not be taken for granted that it, by a mere delegation, it's a blanket decision. So I think after having carefully looked at the background to that whole debate, the word in writing was included. With respect to what Mr. Jeffrey said, it is logically correct that a decision will be reduced to writing into a resolution. But for the purposes of emphasizing the seriousness of the delegated authority, the operative word in writing was inserted. Those are my submissions.
Disciplinaries, how many of them are there in the attorney's profession? One has the impression very, very, very many. And they're dealt with as being stand by the law societies, right? So, I mean, we know who they're going to stay there, don't we? I mean, it's not as if this council is going, or if they do, if the council sits down and delegates in writing the function of hearing the disciplinaries. I mean, how silly. I mean, this is a function done by the law societies or the bars, as the case may be. And although they are not satisfactory in all respects, Mr. William Saunders and Mayor has been doing some very interesting journalistic work on the lack of transparency, for example, isn't it?
I'll
forward to you.
Please, yes.
Send them to me. And we need to think about writing in some transparency. But that's off the point slightly. The thing is just, we
we're talking about considerable volumes as far as I can see from the outside, and it is at the provincial level or at the bar level that this is going to go on happening. It just is. And so now why create a regime under which anything these people already do, and the voluntary associations and the whole constitutional question will come into it also. Why create a regime under which this new council must delegate powers before they can do anything or go on doing what it is they're doing? A council like this surely is there to think about the more abstract things that are good for the country and for the legal profession and for access to justice and the rule of law.
Chairperson, my understanding of the bill is to look at a governance structure that would be efficient, more efficient, more streamlined, and there's also a costing aspect that we should not forget about, because currently the manner in which the structures are funded has been criticized with regard to duplication, and there has been submissions made in regard to that by the Federalty Fund. So at the end of the day, the model of governance that is agreed upon might very well be a central run organization, very similar to the Law Society of the Northern Provinces, which deals with almost 60% of the profession, and it does so by taking care of Gauteng and Mpumalanga, Northwest, Limpopo, and there's a fifth. So that structure currently is almost a national structure because it accounts for 60%. And all of those disciplinary functions are done in Pretoria. So when we come to the stage at which we look at what is the best model that will work efficiently, is it a model that will be a national structure with national committees that will meet as and when it has to deal with matters in the TEL and there's a national there are national committees? What is the most efficient structure to deal with that? Do we have to entrench the existing provincial system of discipline, or whether it can't be done nationally? I think when we get to that hard discussion, it will be linked to how do we cost it and what will be most efficient. So, having listened to Honourable Smuts, I say the following, that I don't agree that it will naturally flow from this bill, that the existing structures will be installed. I don't read that at all.
We're dealing with a number of topics, but firstly the delegation writing. I hear what Mr. Dyer says, he hears what I say, but I would prefer that, please, can you look at the wording, we don't have to finalize it now, may resolve delegates or by, may delegate by resolution. My objection was to the issue of in writing, because it where the council has to take a decision, so I would have thought, and this is what I want you to consider, may delegate by resolution, by way of resolution or something like that. I have a problem with the ability to the second Law Society point of delegating to the executive office or employees, so that would be included under the 1A to D list that would have come after that. What I'm a bit worried about, and maybe you can just help here, is the sub-delegation. In law, in terms of sub-delegation, it's not allowed in terms of the statutes we pass, as far as I recall. You can delegate, but it can't be further delegated, as far as I recall. Yeah. Now, do you want, so the perspective of the department has no objection to the sub-delegation. I'm not sure I'm happy with that, because the council may say, okay, we'll delegate this issue to the regional council, and then the regional council says, oh no, we'll delegate that to a staff member. And that wasn't maybe the intention of the original body. And surely there's nothing stopping the regional council going back to the national council to say, look, this function you've delegated to us, we want to delegate to one of our staff members or something like that, one of our committees. Then they can get the national to to approve that by resolution. So what I'm saying is the first one of some dedication I'm not comfortable with. I won't take it any further than that. And then I don't have a problem with the second part. And then I would suggest that Mr. Dyer can and then come back to us after he's thought about it, may delegate by resolution any of his powers.
Advocates across the province, etc. So we thought that would keep all the dynamics in mind.
but the way 23-2 reads is that the minister may decide to have two regional councils for Gauteng, because there's a lot of lawyers, and I don't think that's the intention. Surely the issue is that one, is it correct that this is a power solely exercised by the minister, after consultation? I mean, it should not be for the National Council to decide in consultation with the minister, or the minister to decide in consultation with the council, regional council.
For what do you want the minister?
Has been
being powerful.
Yes.
Then Paul, you had four laws of consciousness. So they were just giving it a little name change. Okay?
Alright. To Mr. Dunn, I mean, I'm not saying that there must be one for each province. I'm just saying that these should be provincially based. You don't want two things. You don't want more than one in the province, so you don't want two in Gauteng. Then you don't want those provinces. So you can take a decision that Northwest and Northern Cape will have one council. But then it should follow the jurisdictions of both high courts. So you don't have to have one for each province, but you can't have more. And when you have overlapping areas of jurisdiction, the whole province needs to come in. Because otherwise you're not going to have the jurisdictions of the High Court developing their own sort of common understanding of issues. So what I'm saying is definitely if you want to keep the northern provinces, if it is to remain, that's fine, but then it must be the whole of Northwest, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Gauteng. You can't have a bit of Mpumalanga going to KZN when it's under the High Court of Mpumalanga.
Mm. All right, Mrs. Sloan, you wanted to...
The current attorney act is used to an extent province-based because an attorney is admitted in that specific province. And that was the old four provinces. But still moved away from that, in that we admitted as an attorney and admitted in the whole country as is currently the position under the Admission of Advocates Act. Secondly, I just want to point out that of this consultation, in consultation, that we did audit of all the provisions in the bill that provide for consultation. It's a lengthy document, and maybe I think we would suggest at a certain stage that be taken into account individually. As Honourable Jeffrey referred to that. The next comment on 23 was from the JCB. They decided that the regional council for attorneys should be created in accordance with the needs of the attorney profession and then be funded by the attorneys in that region, and that the regional council for advocates must be created in the areas of the jurisdiction of high courts, and they go further and propose that existing regional bar councils become the statutory regional council. The department's response is that this model proposed constitutes that the regional councils are being subdivided into two separate chambers, each doing what they currently do, and this boils down to the retention of current arrangements. The department is of the view that this will depend on the issues that they will seek to transform. And clause 23 currently allows the regional councils to carry out their powers and functions as may be determined by the council. Yes, if I could just latch onto that, Alex's Alice comment is similar.
not have more to say.
Why is it not in consultation? What is the decision of the department on that? What happens if the negotiations, if you look at reciprocal agreements, there's negotiations with a particular country who are very keen for their lawyers to be able to practice here, and because of other things, part of the package of agreements were made, the minister then feels obliged to allow them, because we're getting the countries in return getting a whole lot of other benefits, which may be good benefits, but the standards of the profession are affected.
Yeah.
So why this after consultation not in?
I apologize for that now. And as I said, we did do an audit of all the clauses, and it appears that it would be advisable that most of them be in consultation. That was our conclusion.
Mr. Dyer, I don't know if you
the other thing is the document that would be submitted for consideration that Ms. Lowe spoke about would deal with the obvious deadlock when you're in consultation. And we have looked at that possibility, and we have a suggested solution as well. Because in consultation does not necessarily mean that all will be fine. Having done that, you have totally differing views. Then you have a deadlock. Then you have to have a mechanism to deal with the outcome. So we have considered that, and so when we make that submission on these points, we will talk to that as well.
Right. Mr. Jeffrey?
We need to make that submission. Because, look, you're right, I see two conflicting interests. The council may not want to have more lawyers coming into the country, so they may try and block it. The minister may be subject to political pressures. You have an agreement with this country. They will accept not having tariffs on a number of our products, but in return, they want their lawyers to be able to practice here. The minister then feels under political pressure to allow them to do that. So you've got those two powers that you need to keep in check. So I agree that in consultation may just result in a deadlock, but then I think it's important to hear what is your suggestion for breaking it. Are you ready with it through your chair? Are you ready with it here? Because let's hear it now if you are.
Okay. So just in brief, an overview, I think there's a similar provision, there is a similar provision in the Judicial Service Judicial Service Commission Act. I don't know whether Ms. Lowe has got it here. But in the case of the deadlock, the matter gets referred to Parliament for a decision. I think that's it. That is it. Yeah.
Okay.
We have got the Judicial Service Commission. If we can get it for me, have you got it?
No. When you have it, you can.
But I think what they're suggesting is in consultation, and if there is no agreement, then it goes to Parliament to decide.
Slow.
Any amendment there to each side of in Parliament in terms of the subject
present regulations require approval by Parliament. And that is in Section 94.
Yes.
And the term is after consultation. So we've already got a high standard that's required by Parliament, although it is after consultation. So I'm not opposed to that, but it's just our standard here says must be approved by Parliament. It's not even, not tabled. We're saying that it must be approved. So the point is that if you say in consultation plus must be approved by Parliament, we will need that. The deadlock ranking mechanism is to a certain degree already contained there.
Unfortunately, not all the regulation making and identification are included in clause 94.
Mm.
In the text of the bill, sometimes say standalone.
Yeah, sometimes they standalone, Mr. Scott. First, Mr. Jeffrey, and then you, Mr. Bessin.
The other difference is that usually our regulation powers relate to approval or rejection. In the case that's quoted, the example that's quoted, we do have the power to amend. And I think that power is useful in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe it
should be
used
to come back. Should be who?
Yeah,
national
competence.
76.
Okay.
can't.
You might compile clinic while you're writing.
Yes, yes.
If you compile that,
then you're okay.
Jefferson clause 24 still unique about feels that it appears that admission as a South African citizen in court is more onerous and expensive process than for foreign legal practitioners. And the department response is that foreigners will ultimately also have to be admitted by the High Court in terms of this bill. But I don't know if this provision should be expanded or verified.
Technically, it could be less onerous. That's why we want three to be this role for Parliament in consultation, a joint agreement between the Council, the Minister, and if they don't agree, then Parliament can make changes.
Can you hear you, Mr. Shepherd? You wanted to be wrong.
They commented that the university curricula and education system must be monitored.
By whom?
I didn't say it. This is the foreign qualifications.
Oh, of both universities.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I apologize. This is a bit in isolation here. But our response is that it is a function of the Parliament in terms of Clause 65, so I just wanted to refer to the level.
Ask him.
Clause 25 deals with the right of appearance, and it provides that any person who has been admitted and enrolled to practice as a legal practitioner is entitled to practice throughout the Republic. And secondly, a legal practitioner who is practicing as an advocate or an attorney has the right to appear on behalf of any person in any court in the Republic. So we are opening up right of appearance to attorneys, a blanket. ESCOM commented that a non-practicing attorney who is a full-time legal advisor has the right of appearance on behalf of the employer's conditions to be set. We just referred to that previously, but the report's response is also that this could be considered for the in regulations. But I think we just concluded that a person would have to comply with the provisions of this law before he can appear.
Ms. Adams.
Chairperson, just with regards to the right of appearance of candidate legal practitioners, it is in 94.1H. But I just think that we should also make a reference to that clause, even that clause 25, just so that if you read right of appearance, it's not just for practicing legal practitioners, but it is also for the candidate legal practitioners, as what is currently the case in any event. And we all know that regulations will be set for that. But that just so that when we read this section, the impression is not created that we forgot about the candidate legal practitioners.
That's a good point. We haven't dealt with Eskom's demand, though. Mr. Nalimichaka.
would it be just fall under genital requirements?
Listen, yes, a person can appear when he complies with all requirements of the bill, irrespective of the full time. I think they're confusing the issues a bit.
idea that we need to look at that in the context of the independence, they being officers of the court, the issue of the Rifan cover, over and above all of that, the definition currently of what a practicing attorney is. Because it's not just ESCOM, SASOL, it's every conceivable industry that has legal advice, and whether they have conflicted in the sense of they get paid by an employer, and that's where their allegiance is.
I still have a lot of support, sympathy for not having, not allowing the big corporations to employ their own attorneys who are on their payroll to appear for them, because I mean, and it's probably in the interest also of the shareholders, the employed attorney may have their own interests that they're pursuing, not wanting to cover up that they've made a mistake or something like that, whereas if the contract is given to a second person, an outside attorney, who is not, might be dependent on that particular company for a lot of work, but at least has a separation. So I think, and then you don't have, that attorney is not independent if they're on the payroll of ESCOM or Sasol or Anglo-American or whoever.
In common law, there's no specific contractual agreement that satisfy the transfer of the transfer cost. It's usually the contract is the buyer. Because all contract standards put in is the buyer, but if there's no stipulation, as far as I can remember, but
besides the point. But it's also linked to the issue of I mean, having said that, not wanting the banks or whatever to employ their own attorneys or advocates, and I think the comparative study shouldn't just be America, but just the other developed countries, let's say. But then having, I do dislike the Tesco, attorney, who's presumably somebody employed by Tesco. So I don't know how that works in Britain. All right. My argument would be in terms of access to justice. The big firms, the companies can afford to, they don't need to employ lawyers. They can afford to have lawyers that they attorneys, advocates that they instruct and they brief. But when it comes to this arrangement as with, say, Clicks and Clicks pharmacies, where you go to, well, the Tesco example we were given from Britain, you go in to go and buy your groceries and you go to Tesco, the legal counter to get your will drawn up, where that is being done as a service offered by the company for its customers. But I don't know how that works as far as protection. There is more legal advice. Presumably those lawyers are not litigating, they're more just assisting with basic contracts and things like that. But I think Ms. Smuts, I do like the idea of the Tesco.
No, I
like it. Oh, okay, Ms. Schaefer then, sorry. Sorry, Kelly, I confused you again, you look so like Ms. Schaefer.
Yeah, I'll
say the final thing in my mind about this, it just boils down to conflict of interest. And here's the example. The company says to the in-house lawyer, who now has a right of appearance in court, look, this is what you've done, we've messed up. Well, you're not going to put that before the court. So that person is conflated because he's getting a salary and bonus by his employer, but we want to see him as an officer of a court to argue a case before a judicial officer and put all the facts before the court. It's a serious conflict. It's conflicted, and it doesn't matter how you recognize it internationally, you're conflicted.
I agree.
We can dispose of it now.
Thank you.
advocates to take direct briefs, provided they have a Fidelity Fund certificate. Yeah. If you're an advocate and you don't want to take a direct brief, then you don't have to get a Fidelity Fund certificate. That's your choice. And so I think it should be explicit. And my worry with the way that things work is that in theory we're passing a law which can just allow unrestricted direct briefs if the minister opts not to make any regulations.
Mr. Bassett. Chair, I think I need to take it back, committee members, back to the history. This is one of the provisions of 34.2 that came right at the end. The bill was premised on the referral general rules as a referral system, and this was put in right at the end. And the referral system as a general rule was always premised is one of the concessions that was, or compromises that was made, in order to take the process forward. But that is something that the committee can decide on. I'm not saying that we must move in any direction, but just to remind you where it comes from, the context.
Since I get it, the committee is in favour of what is in 34.2.
I think if anyone opposed to allowing direct peace, so that premise may have from the committee side gone. As I said, if anybody is supporting the status quo, maybe they should speak out. But obviously, I think it would certainly be consensus that it be accompanied by Fidelity Fund certificate to protect the client. So that we would need to put in. And then the difficulty with the 342B is that the way it stands is it's direct briefs without restriction are possible if the minister decides not to make any regulations. And we don't want to go that far. And I don't think anybody wanted to go that far. We might have persisted in, but I don't think that was the intention. But that's the view of the, I think that was the view of the committee. So I think if I'm correct, I mean, I see Ms. Swans has her hand up, she has been nodding, that what we would like to see is provision for direct briefs once provided the advocate has a Fidelity Fund certificate. And then there can be other regulations or whatever that the minister can make, so that's not a problem, but at least that's the minimum.
Ms. Swans and then Ms. Milano-Majakis.
Yes, just to reiterate, I am in favour of the split provision. The referral is the cornerstone of the split provision. And it is in full acknowledgement of that fact that I nevertheless maintain the position that there is room for relaxation of the referral rule. I think there's going to be a great deal of unhappiness about this. But the reasons why I believe that there should be a relaxation are those set out by Judge Cameron in 1999 in Perfectus. And for practical reasons such as the fact that young women advocates do not get the work that they could, in my view, at least partially because of the referral rule, and attorneys are not briefing them, and they are placed in their expensive chambers, which they are forced to maintain, and if they're lucky, they get family law cases. But I think that this is one of the ways to break the log jams that exist in this country. I think there is going to be much unhappiness, but those are the reasons why I support it. And yes, I support the proposal for the Fidelity Fund.
First, Ms. Milano-Majakis, and then you, Mr. Kassar.
Thank you. I'm in support of the idea of direct briefs, which is in line with the intention of the bill. So my worry is the area of the Fidelity Fund certificate. They are optional. The advocates are not intending to have access to. How do you then monitor that area?
First, Mr. Scusana, and then you, Mr. Blair.
Actually, what is conflict in the department following the deliberations of this committee. And also, we have that necessitates some consequential amendments of the bill, of those clauses which deals with the first actually bring those who are willing to continue the judgment, because some of them, most of them are sponsored, they said, look, some of them said they would still pay their letters, but they were trying to not learn the administration of sending money. I think the benefit of the current rule is that you don't get too much involved in keeping books and accounts and whatever, just that you are managed forward from that line, you are paid.
If we say that advocates can now practice, can get directories provided that they have a fidelity fund certificate, doesn't that mean that we have to change the definition of advocate? Because it says yes, that it's a legal practitioner without the fidelity fund. So then what are we going to say? Are we going to differentiate between... under the definition.
I think we already looked at that. argument, but you're resource of Cameron.
Yes.
That is also
Britain, where our England, where our legacy comes from, has lost it.
Then he kind of, what's the word, reconciles you. I mean, if you're not having a good profession anymore, then you're undermining the very principle of referral rule
exists. It seems to me, Chair, that whether you, I mean, in the countries that have abolished the dual, the two, the bar and the sidebar, it seems anyway that you've got what were formerly known as the doing that work, and you've got people who are formerly known as advocates specializing in court work, and you've effectively got that. With a referral rule being dropped, for example, in England, you then would have some advocates taking jury briefs, and you have others who don't, and some who are doing both. So, you know, you seem to end up at the same place.
Yeah.
Generally, but I think. I think that the point is that on Mr. Schaefer's point, that we must be one of the few countries left in the world which doesn't have direct peace when you've got a split bar. Well, it's very crucial for those who want to maintain the status quo for their own interests.
No, it's not just that. Look at the whole basis of the role of the advocate. And it's not by accident that the judges traditionally have been drawn from the ranks of the advocates. They are independent. They're independent thinkers. They're independent actors. They go in with the whole body of the law in their background and apply the settled law to whatever the case is. That is, it's what makes the whole system work. And that's why they are so crucial in their arguments before the judges. The judges benefit from those arguments. But the profession, it isn't going to disappear if you relax the referral rule. I think what Mr. Dyer said down is exactly right. You're going to have some, remember, advocates argues, but then just like the attorneys. Why give advocate that? They can say, that's not true. Run offices, they run administrative services for the purposes of the offices. In practice, we all get the impression that they don't appear in court so very much, despite the law having been changed. And an advocate does another thing. He sits in a chamber, he's not burdened by administration, he thinks and he goes out into the arena and he does the fighting and argumentation, but he does so off a basis of independence, which serves the country, the legal system, the bench very well.
For me, the justification for maintaining the split profession is the only conceptual argument for me is the referral rule and the cap rank rule. If it's not that you take the referral with directly, that's not the referral rule which is applicable anymore, and that undermines the respect for the distinction.
I've got Mr. Skosana, Ms. Silkstone, and then Mr. Dyer. And then you need to tell me what time we're going to stop. After Mr. Dyer, right.
Just 2 points. Obviously, when, as Mr. Butler said, when we include this problem at that stage, but because of the consent of people having to pay two lawyers for the service of one.
Mm.
But the problem is that even they don't have any contract with the second one. So amendment is going to require a number of consequential amendments, but I think other amendments we can work through, suggest when Parliament members and welcome the question.
Thank you.